Views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. This is Bob McChesney, and I'm your host on WILL AM 580 here in Urbana, Illinois. Today we have a tape show for you, taped a couple weeks before we went on air when we had an opportunity to get a terrific guest who we might not otherwise have been able to get. And that guest is Laura Flanders, and she's the author of a new book called Bush Women, Tales of a Cynical Species. And I'd like to read just a little bit about the book before we talk to Laura. From the workplace to the war zone, the Bush administration has wrapped female-friendly rhetoric around some of the most hardcore policy since Ronald Reagan. Some well-placed women have helped to pull off that con job. Invaluable to the president, under-scrutinized in the press, the Bush women, the women appointed to the inner circle of the president's cabinet and sub-cabinet, are cast in the public mind as moderate, malleable, maverick, irrelevant, or benign. Their carefully crafted images tap into stereotypes, while the reality of their records has remained out of sight. That was written, that's in the dust jacket of the new book, Bush Women, by our guest today, Laura Flanders. And Laura Flanders, who joins us, is the host of Your Call, a radio program on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. She writes regularly for TomPaine.com, ZNet, The Nation, appears often on TV. She was the founding director of the Women's Desk at the Media Watch Group Fair, and the author of a terrific book before this, Real Majority, Media Minority, The Cost of Sidelining Women in Reporting, which I had the privilege of not only reading but using in my classes. Laura Flanders, welcome to Media Matters.
Oh, thanks for having me, Bob. It's great to be here.
It is really an honor to have you here. And I've just gotten it, and just before we went to tape the show, and it's really a page-turner. It's so full of material I wasn't aware of. I mean, it's really got a lot of new stuff here. It's a story that really hasn't been told before.
It's a whole bunch of stories that haven't been told.
I mean, what drove you to write this book, Bush Women?
Well, I just thought we were being snowed, you know? When the Bush administration were inaugurated, and we know they weren't exactly elected, but when they came into power, we got all these stories about how Bush was pulling together a cabinet that represented the breadth and width of America, diversity, multiculturalism. There's a bunch of women, there's African Americans, there's an Arab American, a Democrat, a pro-choice Republican. I thought we were being snowed. And we heard all these stories about these women in particular and their personal stories and what they like to eat and what they like to wear, and remarkably little about what actually qualified them to hold any of these jobs or not, and what was actually in their political as opposed to their personal pasts.
Now, is this the sort of thing, though, that Clinton did, too? I mean, is this standard operating procedure for presidents, or did you find the situation with the Bush administration, you know, more striking in this regard?
Well, I think it is absolutely standard operating procedure, and cabinet secretaries are often exactly that, kind of window dressing to sort of make the administration look pretty to constituencies it's trying to attract. In this case, though, I thought it was fascinating because George W. Bush models himself in many ways on the administration of Ronald Reagan. And in Ronald Reagan, there was virtually, as Susan Faludi put it, no women allowed picket sign on the lawn of the White House in Washington. It was a very different picture back then. You had Jean Kirkpatrick, pretty much the only female member of the cabinet, U.S. Secretary, representative to the ambassador to the United Nations. There weren't any women in the picture. And the ever since that election, 1980, the Republican Party has paid a price for a gender divide in the nation. Its policies have led women to prefer Democrats for president by, in the case of Al Gore, some 10-11%. So the Bush administration comes in needing to address its female problem at the polls and brings us all these women who I thought were worth taking a second look at, because in fact we need to learn about how the right has cultivated women and people of color who are conservative, who toe their line, but make their image look very different.
So this is driven, you're arguing, really by very serious political concerns.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a gender gap at the polls, has been for 25 years. In order to become president, the candidate has to win a good proportion of the women's vote. This has always been hard for Republican presidents. It looks like it's going to be very hard for George W. in 2004. You've got polling now suggesting that some 64 5% of single women think the country is headed in the wrong direction. Women are the majority of voters in this country. They vote at a far greater rate than men. They're also a majority of the population. This is an important swing block, and particularly married suburban women are the largest kind of swingers out there and the biggest swing bloc within the Republican reach. 2000, as I said, there was a 10-point, 11-point gender gap pending, you know, leaning Gore's way. In 2002, that gap had shrunk by a significant percent in the midterm elections. I think that had to do more with low turnout and 9/11. But you can be sure that Bush's team are very concerned to win as much of the women's vote as they can to narrow that gap. And we're going to see more and more of these women on the campaign trail as the election heats up, as the White House tries to do just that.
We're talking to Laura Flanders, the author of Bush Women, today on Media Matters. This is a pre-recorded show. We taped it a couple weeks before we went on air, so please do not try to call in. Just sit back and relax and let us do the chatting for the next 50 minutes or so. Laura, you know, do these Bush women have a positive influence? Are they moderating the sort of rough edges of the Texan George W. Bush and making him more humane and more sensitive to the downtrodden and the needs of those who don't have a great deal of power or influence in our society?
I think the answer is no, but they're making us, the public, think they are. I mean, some say David Frum wrote in his book about the White House that Karen Hughes did try to get Bush to change his language around the environment, because in August of 2001, he was going down the tubes in terms of polling, particularly among women, the abandonment of the Kyoto Treaty and several other environmental decisions coming out of the White House had really alienated particularly women voters. That was a critical moment. August 2001, the president's numbers were at the lowest of any president in his first year for years. And what did they do? Well, they convened a group of women to meet with the editors of this country's newspapers, and they basically sort of deployed their female faces, Condoleezza Rice, Karen Hughes, Christy Todd Whitman, to talk to the press, specifically to try to reach out to those women who seem to be running away from the Bush administration. They had a whole campaign called Winning Women that was chaired by the new co-chairwoman of the RNC, Ann Wagner, who was constantly described as a 38-year-old suburban mom, exactly that demographic they were trying to reach. Now, you know, the attacks of September 11th had American voters swinging heavily towards supporting their commander-in-chief, but you get the story, you follow the story over the last 4 years, and repeatedly the Bush administration is in trouble with women, and repeatedly they go and try to pursue women voters, deploying again these women leaders. In 2003 in California, one of the team working for the election of Governor Schwarzenegger was a woman who declared that this is an opportunity to target disaffected voters, especially women. A memo got out, and she said, "It's important that we use this opportunity to present an image of diverse Republican women. We want to make sure the media are steered toward the common sense women against Gray Davis angle, the Democrat, and we're working on getting a big name female draw for each local event." I'm saying that there is a very careful, methodical lot of thinking going into the political use of these women. Whether they actually affect the policy, well, I don't think they do at all.
And there's no evidence in your view that there are better policies as a result of these women participating in leadership roles in this administration. They aren't getting the sort of policies that would benefit women.
I don't think they care that much. I mean, these are not people whose expertise is in gender politics or equality or civil rights or any of the rest of it. They're all, I mean, Condoleezza Rice is expert in foreign policy and cutting up deals for oil companies. That's where her history is. That's where her background is. She's not an expert in civil rights, even if she grew up in segregated Birmingham. That's her experience, and she brings her experience to what she does, but her expertise lies elsewhere.
In fact, in the book, Bush Women, that Laura Flanders, our guest, wrote, and that we're talking about right now, the brand new book, you go through several of the Bush women, give them each their own chapters, the lead Bush women, I guess you could call them. And Condoleezza Rice gets the first major chapter in this regard, a long one. Karen Hughes, Ann Veneman, Elaine Chao, Christine Todd Whitman and Gail Ann Norton each get a chapter. Let's just talk briefly about these women, what they're made of. And I think most of our listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with many of these names, although perhaps not all of them.
Yeah, I think some of them people haven't heard of, but yeah. I would suggest they should.
Yeah.
I mean, who do you want to start with?
Let's go down the list here, and let's go with Condi.
All right, Condi
Rice, who's probably the best known of all the Bush women.
Well, this is a classic piece of media in the coverage of Condi. I mean, when she was appointed National Security Advisor, she had done a lot. She had directed an oil company. She'd managed a multi-million-dollar university. She'd served as a Sovietologist in Washington during the collapse of the Soviet Union. She was taking this position in her second Bush administration, the top national security position in the cabinet. But when the New York Times ran a story on Condoleezza Rice, it didn't discuss her views on national security or foreign policy until the 27th paragraph. It came up right at the end of a very long feature dominated by talk of her dress size, her hair, her hemline, her place of birth. The Times wrote classic things like, she eats either a bagel or cereal every day for breakfast. She's always impeccably dressed, usually in conservative jewelry. It reported that she keeps two mirrors on her desk, apparently to check the back as well as the front. And then, oh yes, she has an oil supertanker named after her, a result of being on the Chevron Corporation board. That was it for discussion of Rice and Chevron. I mean, classic stuff, and it really provokes one's curiosity. What else is there in this woman's past? How did she go from segregated Birmingham, Alabama to the White House, not once but twice? I found it kind of a fascinating story, and more fascinating almost than any other aspect was the way that she deploys a personal narrative that people kind of draw conclusions from. Conclusions that I suggest need to be reviewed. For example, she speaks to the Republican National Convention in 2000 in Philadelphia and talks about her father being a Republican, the first Republican she ever knew. The implication is he's a Republican who supports Republican policies. She continued and talked about her grandfather and her family who had made it by their own merits, by dint of hard work, as if to suggest that this is America of opportunity for everybody if you just work hard enough. A classic conservative line. Really spine-tingling stuff for Republican spinmeisters who did very well with Clarence Thomas's story of making it from the outhouse to the courthouse, again, with no government help. He had tons of government help, affirmative action, welfare, and a benevolent grandfather who helped him get through school and didn't do the same for his sister. Condoleezza Rice's grandfather is long gone, but her father died soon after she joined the administration. Go back in history and you can find record of Dean Rice. His name was John Wesley Rice. He was a dean at Stillman University in Alabama. He was assistant dean of arts and sciences at Denver University after affirmative action. In the early 60s, he didn't support the children's demonstrations going up against Bull Connor's hoses and dogs. But a lot of civil rights activists didn't support the sending of children into the streets. It was a controversial tactic. The fact that he kept his daughter Condi, his only daughter, out of those streets didn't mean that he opposed the movement. Far from it. He raised money for Ralph Abernathy, really the right-hand man of King in the state at the time. When he was at Denver University, he was also the first administrator of Head Start, interestingly, in Birmingham. He was an educator. He believed very strongly in integrating campuses and educating Americans about racial, white supremacist thinking in this country and the history of white supremacy and apartheid in America. At Denver University, he started a program called the Black Experience in America, where he brought black speakers to speak to the predominantly white campus. And who did he bring? He brought Fannie Lou Hamer, Andrew Young. He brought Dennis Brutus, the exiled South African poet. And he brought Louis Farrakhan of the Nation of Islam. This is not a man whose character is all-encompassed in the sentence that Condoleezza Rice uses. He was a Republican, the first Republican I ever knew. Way more complicated than that. And I actually dug up a speech that he gave in May 1971 on the anniversary of the police killings of anti-war protesters at Kent State and civil rights activists at Jackson State, where he looked out into the crowd, and it's chilling. He looked out to the crowd and he said, "You are the capitalists of tomorrow. You are the politicians of tomorrow. You are the business people of tomorrow, the educators of tomorrow. Will you be agents of war or will you be agents of peace? Will you bring this nation to a lasting peace or did your brothers and sisters at Kent State and Jackson State die in vain?" I mean, to think about that in retrospect, I asked the question. His own daughter became businessman, politician, educator, you name it. Has she been a peacemaker? I think it's a very big question.
We're talking to Laura Flanders today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Laura Flanders is the author of the new book, Bush Women, Tales of a Cynical Species, which has just come out, published by Verso. I urge you all to take a look at it. And this is a pre-recorded show. We did it shortly before going on air, so please don't try to call today. Just sit back and listen and let the professional yakkers yak. Laura, you mentioned at the outset of the discussion of Condi Rice, the New York Times profile of Condoleezza Rice that went 27 paragraphs before it got into the substance of her position and what her views were on policy. Now, how much of that is just the sexism built into mainstream journalism coverage of women in positions of power? And how much of that is almost intended or desired by the Bush administration to have this sort of view of their women?
Well, who knows? I mean, I think there is a spin that is put on this that this administration puts on its interviews, and this is not an administration that leaves it to chance what is discussed with journalists. And I should say, not one of the subjects of this book would speak to me, although I made many, many attempts to conduct interviews. This is not a group that take their PR casually. On the other hand, you know, I think that the press are, I mean, to one extent, of course. Condoleezza Rice is a first. She's a trailblazer. That's inherently newsworthy. She's no question one of a kind. But there is, I think, a kind of racism and sexism happening to continue to tell just this one part of her story, when surely her story, the role that she played in the first Bush administration, the role that she played at Chevron, the role that she played at Stanford as provost, are equally worthy of attention. I don't think, I mean, to be fair, there is perhaps good reason why we don't hear that much about Dick Cheney's youth as a white man in pre-civil rights Nebraska. Maybe it's not such an interesting story. In fact, I'd quite like to hear more about it. But there's no reason why that's all we hear about in Condoleezza Rice's case. And I think that that's just journalistic laziness and kind of, well, you talk about it a lot, lack of courage by the reporter. They'd rather sit down with a cozy story than really challenge their interview subjects, particularly if their subjects have a lot of power.
And what is there in Condoleezza Rice's professional history, outside of her personal history, that readers are going to learn in your book that probably isn't covered that much in the press? I'm thinking specifically about Chevron. But
well, exactly. Yeah. I mean, when, you know, I had this question, her father's question, are you an agent of war or of peace, in my mind, and I started researching and I talked to the women of Nigeria, the women of the Niger Delta, and they would say that Condoleezza Rice has been anything but an agent of peace in their lives. The Chevron Corporation under Condoleezza's directorship, and she was on the board, was cutting deals with the dictatorship, brutal dictatorship of Sani Abacha. This was the period where the Shell Oil Corporation was collaborating in the killing of Ogoni activists, Ken Sarawiwa and others. Nigeria stands accused of being responsible for the death and by state military shooting of Niger Delta activists. Women during this period took over oil platforms and, as you may remember, sort of stripped down to their bare breasts, just appealing for some justice, for some health care, for some access to the resources that lay beneath their land and for an end to the environmental ravaging of their communities. Throughout that period, this wasn't a secret story, and there were shareholders at Chevron who were bringing shareholder initiatives before the board. Condoleezza Rice sat on the Social Policy Committee of Chevron, a small group, just six, who would review those shareholder resolutions and decide whether or not they should go to a vote before the whole board. Every time those resolutions were rejected, every single time. And Condoleezza's line is that, you as a corporation can't pick and choose which governments you deal with, and that economic engagement ipso facto builds democracy. I think that's open for debate. At the very least, the public need to know about it. The without knowing about it, you can see when you see Dick Cheney, you can virtually see the oil contract sprouting out of his head. I mean, he reads now as, you know, oil man, Halliburton. Condoleezza Rice doesn't read that way. And It's partly to do with the stereotypes in our own minds and the stereotypes in our media. But it's partly to do with she directs the conversation in a different area, into a different focus. And she can say, as she did in the run-up to the occupation of Iraq, this is a civil rights issue of our time, bringing democracy to the people of Iraq. That's what she said to a group of the National Association of Black Journalists, and it kind of resonates in a way that it never would if Dick Cheney tried to say it. But I suggest Condoleezza Rice is as much oil man as Cheney. She just doesn't look it.
In a recent article you had in The Nation, which I think draws partially from the book, but also has some other material in it, Beware the Bush Women, in the March 22nd edition of The Nation, you talk a little bit about Laura Bush, the First Lady, and the role she plays in our current political culture and with the Bush administration and their aims. And talk a little bit about that, because I thought, you know, she's becoming to play a somewhat more prominent role, it seems, in recent times.
Well, more prominent because the press have been paying more attention. I mean, the fascinating thing about her is her greatest asset is this apolitical image that she's created for herself. As you remember, her story was that she was a Democrat, that she never wanted to give a speech, that she doesn't like talking in public, that she's not really political, she's just a librarian. She has been talking in public almost nonstop since she hit the White House, or certainly throughout most of 2002 on. No one is more popular on the campaign trail except for Dick Cheney. And yet when Dick Cheney travels around the country raising money for Bush's re-election campaign, as he did throughout 2002 and 2003, he sounds alarm bells and reporters cover the talk. Laura Bush turns up and barely an eyebrow is raised. If there is an interview, it's a really soft kind of fireplace chat. She, interestingly enough, I think, is deployed to pump up the image of the White House as friendly for moderate voters, to sort of lull. I say that her job is to lull. Laura lulls. Her job is to try to persuade voters that all appearances to the contrary, this administration is not in the grips of the radical right. She's made a point of letting us know that she herself doesn't believe Roe v. Wade should be reversed, and neither does her husband. She actually said right after the State of the Union this year that her husband believes that states should be left to decide the issue of the definition of marriage, a very different line from the one that he was putting out at the very same time. I suggest that she is used to spin a very different constituency at the very same time that Bush is spinning the radical right. So while he is handing out candy to the right, she is tossing bones to the moderates. And it's really then left to the voters to decide which is telling the truth. But I think we're going to see much more of Laura Bush during the election campaign. She's already been out there talking about what a good guy her husband is. She's critical, particularly at a time when his reputation now is as a warrior and as, you know, civil rights abuser, you know, constitutional rights shredder. He is standing in pretty ill odor with moderate voters, with his embrace of the religious right around heterosexist marriage, not to mention a whole lot of other things, including the Patriot Act. It's going to be her job to try to soften that in the same way that Governor Schwarzenegger's wife did it for him. The wives act as kind of character witnesses for their husbands. And I think Laura Bush has been deployed that way since day one.
Now, this issue of heterosexist marriage and the issue of gay marriage, which has now been elevated by the Bush administration, is one of the three major issues of the 2004 presidential race, and has been accepted, as far as I can tell, by the news media as one of the three great issues facing the country. This is sort of a dangerous issue. I mean, the fact that they have to have Laura Bush out there sort of softening it suggests that it's not something they're really comfortable being too emboldened and aggressive in their hostility to gay marriage.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're on a very, as they would say in England, a very tricky wicket here. This is a very kind of delicate branch they're stepping out on. Their coalition for the last 25, 30 years has been a coalition that encompasses, on the one hand, the religious right, those who would have more church and ultimately would like the Constitution to be rewritten in line with the Bible, who absolutely are for government intervention into the private lives of the citizens. That part of the coalition extends right across to the libertarian right and the corporate libertarians, who believe there should be no government intervention, particularly when it comes to environmental regulation, workplace regulation. The government should be out of the place of regulating the economy. And certain portions of the libertarian right, of course, are very serious about personal privacy and don't believe there should be laws on the books governing who should marry whom and who should do what in their bedroom. So this has been a delicate coalition of kind of social control and economic liberty. And I think this is the kind of issue that could work to break that coalition apart. So I do think it makes them very uncomfortable. On the other hand, we don't, I believe, have a very forceful, let's just say, I don't find Democratic candidates articulating a very clear counter argument. I don't think that they are very clear about the rights that people should enjoy in this country. I would say, of course, no one should be discriminated against when it comes to who they choose to marry. I would also say, however, that one's human rights should not depend upon whether or not you are married. And we have right now this focus on marriage coming from the LGBT, the lesbian and gay community, as well as the radical right, in a weird way kind of collaborating to suggest that our problems will be solved if we were granted the right to marriage, that by virtue of our long-standing, loyal, monogamous relationships, we're entitled to state recognition and to financial, economic rights that other people aren't entitled to. Why? Because they're not married, because they're poor, because they're single parents. I think we need to have a very clear framing of this issue that talks about equality, that talks about human rights, and that is very clearly distinct from the right-wing agenda, which right now is pushing the privatization of social problems and blaming poverty on marriage. It started under Clinton in the Personal Responsibility Act. The welfare so-called reform law of 1996 was the first place that you saw marriage being promoted as a solution for poverty. It's not. Poverty is not the result of a series of bad personal choices. I mean, maybe for a few, but not for the society as a whole. But that is the conservative view, that if you're poor, it's your fault, and you should have done something differently, had fewer kids, had more kids, got married, not got married, gone to a different school, got different training. I think the marriage issue is troubling for the right, but I don't think the Democrats have got their head around it yet.
We're talking to Laura Flanders today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Laura is the author of Bush Women, Tales of a Cynical Species, a new book just out by Verso Press. This is a pre-recorded version of Media Matters. We taped it a couple weeks before going on air, so please don't try to call in. Just sit back and listen. In the book, you also talk about Cheney women. There's some of them, too. And hopefully 5 years from now, you aren't going to be writing that book.
Oh, please.
Lynn Cheney has more notoriety than any woman in the Bush-Cheney administration coming into the administration, and more for being really quite out there on the hardcore political right. But she's a novelist, too. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, I think I say in the book that, you know, you have one first lady for each of the constituencies that the Bush administration is trying to attract. You have Laura for the W stands for women moderates. And then you have Lynn Cheney for the W stands for warrior ultra right. Yeah, she's been a culture warrior since her stint at the head of the National Endowment for the Humanities, where she collaborated with those who were raising her. hue and cry about what they complained was political correctness on campus. It was really just the integrating of our campus teaching staffs and the curriculum. But she was there basically baiting certain teachers and writers and academicians and drawing lines about who was acceptable and who was not. We saw it again in the wake of 9/11, where an organization called the American Association of Alumni drew up a list of what they considered unpatriotic acts on campus and named professors who had spoken out, often just saying, why did they attack? Whoever attacked, why was it done? What is the root of the hatred for the United States? Let's look at U.S. policy. That American Association of Alumni was founded by, among others, Lynn Cheney, also Joe Lieberman, let's not forget. There is a question, there was a question in my mind, how did she ever get to be this culture warrior? What are her credentials? Well, largely her credentials were built on that time at NEH. Well, how did she get the job at NEH? She never held any big job before. Her husband was the congressman from Wyoming, but that doesn't necessarily get you a job in D.C. She got the job because she was a published author. Well, what had she published? Well, a couple of not-so-good novels. One, a mystery, murder mystery set in Washington, D.C. The other, this rather breathy gothic romance set in 19th century Wyoming, featuring lesbian love and unmarried sex with condoms on the floor in front of a blazing fire. I mean, kind of juicy stuff. And the character who's clearly the Lynn Cheney character in the book, the protagonist, is someone who ran away from the convent school and joined the musical theater and was instructed in the techniques of basically contraception by the musical theater performance star of her time. This is a woman who came back to Wyoming horrified that women there rejected the use of condoms and found relations with men so both threatening and brutal, and who instead were engaged in, you know, romances among women that the protagonist kind of admires and actually kind of envies at different times in the book, writes about very fondly, very warmly. All of this is simply to say, those who steer our ship of state have a compass that they would have us believe is fixed and firm. It's not. They've been all over the map. They know better than this. They show compassion to those in their own family, and they show all sorts of open-mindedness to their own that they do not now show to others. This is a woman who, like George Bush's father himself, who was once called Rubbers when he was a congressman from Texas because he was so much an advocate of contraception and family planning. These are people who have shaped their political opinions to gain power and who are now using that power. I mean, talk about condoms. Lynn Cheney is now part of an administration that is denying condoms to entire countries of Africa where people with HIV are literally dying as a result. It's funny on the one hand, and we had a hysterical staged adaptation of Lynn Cheney's book recently in New York that was to celebrate the publication of Bushwomen, Tales of a Cynical Species. The book we're discussing is hysterically funny. The writing is wild. And on the other hand, there's a not funny side. At least, at the very least, these people need to be seen for what they are.
And the Cheneys, Lynn and Dick, their daughter is a lesbian.
Is an out lesbian. Comfortable being out for many years. She worked for the Coors Corporation. Again, here's somebody who is obviously treated as an equal in the administration. She's heading up Dick Cheney's re-election campaign, the first to go on staff there. Why is equality okay for her, but homophobia has to be the law of the land for the rest of us?
Very good question. We're talking to Laura Flanders today, the author of Bushwomen. I'm Bob McChesney, the host of Media Matters, the show you're listening to today on WILL AM 580. The book also goes through many other prominent women in the Bush administration. And some of these, I'm going to skip ahead if I can to Christine Todd Whitman, because she was the head of the EPA for a long time and was sort of held out, I think, as the sort of conscience of the environment in the Bush administration. What's her story?
Well, you know, this is where we get down to the media analysis that you're so excellent at, Bob. I mean, in our country, journalists tend to define liberal or conservative political views in social terms. So Christy Todd Whitman gets called a liberal. Why? Well, because she is pro-choice. But if you were to look at her economic policies, here's somebody who came to power as the governor of New Jersey in 1993, promising to cut income taxes by 30% over 3 years and still balance the state budget. An extraordinary promise, and a promise that she followed through on. One that really made her the darling of Republican tax cutters everywhere. In 1996, she was invited to co-host the Republican convention with another rising Republican governor, George W. Bush. You know, that was when the right-wing backlash, rather the anti-right-wing backlash, was in full swing. You had had the Contract on America, the 1994 elections, the right swept to power in both houses of Congress in 94. They put Whitman out there, actually, to counter the Clinton State of the Union that year, rather than Newt Gingrich. And I think there you see another example of, we don't want to show Gingrich, who's our true face, we want to show this governor from New Jersey. And in 96, she played the kind of same role. While the country was experiencing a serious backlash against Gingrich and co, who do they put out in front? This kind of soft-faced woman who has a reputation for being a liberal. People don't follow the economic side of the story. What did she do at that convention? Well, that was a convention where there was a big fight about whether pro-choice Republicans, meaning governors and senators, would be allowed to speak at the convention. Several said, if we can't put out our position on choice, we're not going to speak at all. A lot of pro-choice Republicans expected Christy Todd Whitman to stand up for those Republicans. She didn't. She took the side of Gingrich and Bush and abandoned those pro-choicers who wanted to have a showdown and demand that their views be included. I'm talking about Massachusetts Governor William Weld, Governor of California Pete Wilson. They refused to address the convention rather than bow to the party officials' orders that they not talk about their position on choice. And she went right along. So, you know, it's a more complicated story. Her family have known the Bushes for three generations. She is a born in the, you know, in the wool, died in the wool Republican.
It's a very wealthy family.
Extremely wealthy family. And she's never stepped out of line. She has never told tales out of office. She's never, even when she left the Bush administration, she didn't have a bad word to say. She may have had differences with them over the Kyoto Protocol, but even to this day, she doesn't say it was wrong to pull out. She just said it was done in the wrong way. The American public didn't understand. And then, of course, there's her role in 9/11, where New Yorkers are still seething, and not to mention hacking from coughs, to remember that she came out just days after the attack saying that the air in the city was safe to breathe and the water was safe to drink. She couldn't know that. Nobody could. People in her own EPA said this is unknowable, and every, you know, measurement we're taking shows it's anything but safe. We don't have enough data yet. There's no way we can say what's the urgency. Well, the urgency was they needed to open Wall Street. Open Wall Street they did. Did they get the correct information to the American public? I don't think so. And it's come out much later that even according to the EPA's own investigator, they were under political orders for partisan purposes, taking instructions from the White House about what to say. And Christy Todd Whitman went, again, right along.
We're talking to Laura Flanders today in Media Matters. Please don't call in. This is a taped show. Just sit back and listen. Laura, you know, right now we're looking at John Kerry as the likely candidate for the Democratic Party to run against Bush in the reelection, in the battle to win the vote, and in the battle for women's votes. As a journalist, you assess Kerry and what he stands for. What's your sense of Kerry and how he stands on issues of great importance to women compared to, say, George W. Bush?
Well, I think, you know, women seem to prefer Kerry by 53% to 43%, something like that, according to some CNN polls at the beginning of March. People seem to think Kerry would do a better job on health care. He was ahead of Bush on health care and education. Democratic political strategists say that it's likely there'll be, once again, a big gender gap in favor of the Democrat. I'm not sure how strongly, though, Kerry is standing up for some of the issues that I've talked about, namely human rights detached from marital status, mm-hmm. a social compact between the government and the people. What exactly is going to be Kerry's program to address the changes Bush's Leave No Child Behind Act has put public schools through across the country? I still haven't found out. I think that he'll benefit from a lot of anyone but Bush votes, and for that reason hasn't had to be so specific about exactly what he would do. But there are critical things out there. We need sex education in our schools. We need to do away with this abstinence-only education. By all means, teach abstinence, but not only abstinence. We must tell our young people how to protect themselves and have protected sex. We have a social crisis on our hands of ignorance when it comes to sexual matters, and shame, which doesn't do anybody any good. We have a serious lack of health care. We have the privatization of hospitals, the lack of hospital services, and the growth of Catholic church-run hospitals to fill that horrible health care gap. Those Catholic hospitals must be required to provide the same family planning services, abortion service that are available elsewhere, and the same with the insurance companies. There's a lot to be done, not only to roll back the last 4 years of Bush, but to roll back the years of a Republican House and Senate under Clinton. There's a lot to do. I'm not hearing a very forthright agenda from Kerry, and I'm afraid this whole election is going to be fought on fairly military grounds, with military records and veterans playing a key role. I'm all for veterans, but we need an election that really speaks to everybody's needs.
You know, it was funny. It's 2 decades ago now that when Walter Mondale got the nomination, he had Geraldine Ferraro as his running mate.
Yeah, amazing, isn't it? Two full decades.
Yeah, and at the time, the way it was regarded by many people was something that was long overdue. Yeah. And would be the beginning of something that would now become standard and routine in American politics. And since then, there has been, in fact, an increase in the number of women elected officials, maybe even a dramatic increase in some areas, but certainly an increase from what was almost nothing to something. But now there's almost no talk of having a woman being a presidential candidate or a vice presidential candidate. I mean, it really seems like we're back to 1983.
Yeah, I mean, it is amazing. I mean, I went back, I was still in college just in 1984 when Ferraro was running for vice president with Walter Mondale. And I remember not being all that impressed about her, with her, but I do remember feeling that it was an important historic landmark and watching what happened to that candidacy. And when I went back to research it again, because this was the time when Karen Hughes was just coming into Republican Party politics, and I thought it was interesting that her kind of entry into party politics coincided exactly with this election. She didn't play a role in it. It's just an interesting combination of, you know, synchronicity of factors. That was an election where every piece of dirt that could be dislodged from the earth was hurled at that first female candidate for vice president. I mean, there were legitimate questions about her husband's finances and her own financial filings, but the comparison of the treatment of her or of Hillary Clinton to the treatment of the people now in the White House, and particularly the women in this administration, couldn't be more stark. And if people remember, some of you may remember, that there were these kind of anti-Ferraro flying picket squads that would follow her around everywhere she spoke, putting up signs like "Ferraro, Vice President for Death," calling her a baby killer because she was pro-choice. She couldn't speak anywhere without hecklers basically shutting her down. And a little bit later it came out, journalists, to their credit, found out that these flying picket thugs had nothing, you know, weren't independent aggrieved voters, as the Reagan-Bush campaign said. They were actually coached to say that they were independent citizens, not students working for the Reagan campaign. In fact, they were being coached by the Reagan-Bush campaign, and they were activists for the party. It reminded me of nothing so much as the scene outside the vote count in Florida, where we found out that that supposedly, you know, spontaneous crowd of protesters were in fact flown down from Tom DeLay's office in Washington, D.C. I think the Ferraro campaign is worth taking another look at. I think it sent shockwaves through political circles. Her effort, I think, for all of its flaws, needs to be looked at again as in its historical context. And I think that there was a real setback there when it came to a woman a woman's likelihood of being able to run. I think a lot of people who might have considered it or might have considered having a woman running mate ran away from that prospect after that. On the other hand, the Democratic Party's response, too, was to abandon that idea. And very soon after, you saw the rise of the Democratic National Leadership Committee and Bill Clinton's candidacy, where things like that were very much backburnered. And in fact, the commitment to abortion rights dropped off the DNC platform.
You know, it's ironic the way
The commitment to ERA dropped off the our DNC platform.
Yeah, ironically, the way you describe it, given, say, a double standard between the way the Bush women are covered in the press compared to how Hillary Clinton was covered or how Geraldine Ferraro was covered, suggests that it might be easier for a woman to assume the presidency or vice presidency in this country if she's a Margaret Thatcher, if she's on the political right and, you know, is, you know, not regarded in any way as an advocate of women's rights or of the dispossessed.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I spoke to some of the people who had been on Ann Richards' campaign in 1994 in Texas, and I kicked myself that we journalists didn't pay more attention to that campaign at the time. But I don't know what you make of this. I interviewed some people who were working, as I said, on Richards' campaign up against the campaign for George W. Bush, which even then was run by Karen Hughes and Karl Rove. They said, you know, we always expected journalists to be antagonistic. We never thought of exacting reprisals against journalists that asked difficult questions. Hughes and Rove, particularly Hughes, pioneered really the punishing of troublesome journalists. If you asked a difficult question, you were simply iced the next time. That you were off the bus, the press conference was stopped, you didn't get a chance to ask a question again. That obviously is a different approach from the approach that Democratic candidates have typically taken. And I wonder, you know, what you make of it. I don't know whether that's a route we want to go down, but I do think that there tends to be a discipline to right-wing campaigns and a refusal to answer certain things that we don't see on the other side. Mm-hmm. And also, I just think there's a cold-blooded determination on the side of the right that we sort of lack in the rather spineless, moderate area of the arena.
Well, there are some other women, Bush women, that you cover in the book, Bush Women. We don't have a lot of time left, but I just want to mention them and then talk about them briefly. Karen Hughes, who you've already alluded to several times, Ann Veneman, Elaine Chao, and Gail Ann Norton. Mm. Let's talk a little. Karen Hughes has sort of fallen from view recently, hasn't she?
Well, she came back not so long ago. Not only was she there, of course, at the State of the Union, but when relatives of the dead of 9/11 complained about the first campaign ad of the Bush-Cheney re-election campaign featuring pictures of dead bodies at 9/11 and firefighters and so on and so forth. It wasn't Dick Cheney or anyone else they put out there to contradict the bereaved relatives. It was Karen Hughes. Time for a woman.
I see. And, yeah, it's interesting. If they had done that ad, if a Democrat had done the same footage, then said, why didn't Bush listen to the intelligence reports telling this is going to happen? I wonder if it would have been regarded as a legitimate campaign ad.
I think we'd still be paying for the investigation.
Yeah, I think so, too. Well, what was Karen Hughes? Why is she an important figure?
Well, I mean, I actually have a lot of respect for Karen Hughes. I think she's incredibly powerful, incredibly smart, totally determined. She's somebody who said that she would have liked to have done PR for Exxon after the Exxon Valdez. I mean, that's somebody you just have to kind of stop and think. Mm-hmm. She's totally ambitious, very determined, very disciplined, has really made Bush's candidacies on successive occasions what they are. She's the person that really, I think, defined this for or against us thing and set the tone in the election campaign press pool that made it virtually impossible for journalists to really challenge the president on anything substantive. It therefore creates an environment in which the candidate can be very chummy with reporters because no one who caused any trouble is even on the bus. If you've got Pitbull Hughes there, you're in a pretty safe space if you're the candidate. Her past is kind of interesting. She grew up, she says, as an army brat, and you kind of imagine somebody going from base to base. To some extent, she did, but then in Panama, she lived in very palatial quarters. Her father was the last governor general of Panama, the Panama Canal Zone. He was the man that pulled down the flag. And you'll recall, the question of giving up the canal zone was one of the huge emotive issues, the kind of gay marriage of its day in 1976. Mm-hmm. And her father was deeply involved in this critical moment of American empire. And I wonder whether the sort of ignominious loss to the right, as they see it, the ignominious loss of the Panama Canal Zone has anything to do with the aspiration to expand U.S. empire now.
You know, Laura Flanders, we only have a few minutes left, and because of that, there's an issue I want to talk about because we haven't had a chance to talk about on this show, which is the governor's race for California with Arnold Schwarzenegger, the
right.
recall race, and the charges against him for harassing women, which he did not deny. And how, the fact that that did not undermine the success of his campaign. What was your assessment of the press coverage of those charges, how they were treated?
Well, I think, I've been very hard on the press coverage, and I felt that there were stories that could have been told that weren't. A lot of journalists have contacted me and said, look, we really, really tried. The problem is when people are intimidated, and that Hollywood is a place where a lot of people rely on personal relations to maintain their livelihood. It was very hard to get women to come forward to put their name to their accusations, but there were four, six, at one point eight women who were willing to come forward, six of them with names. There were women in the UK who were willing to talk even on camera. This is a man whose reputation was clear. I don't think it made the slightest bit of difference. People were so furious at Gray Davis. They were so snowed by a media campaign that was in part fueled by a whole television network, NBC, that employed the candidate's wife at the time and was the host of his kickoff campaign on the Leno show, and then had Jay Leno there to celebrate his victory. In the meantime, he appeared in softball interviews on the Sunday shows and on Oprah Winfrey. I mean, you gotta win if you've got a whole TV network working for free on your campaign.
Yeah, I guess what I'm getting at is it just striking that if there had been a reputation of Arnold Schwarzenegger sort of, telling racist jokes.
He did have a reputation for telling racist
even
jokes.
Okay, take that back. Maybe that's not a better, I don't know what a good example
would be. There were black men who were in his gyms throughout the 70s
that's
who
true.
Said he was horribly racist and anti-Semitic too. This is a guy they knew could win, who could play a key role in the Republican Party. And they got him, he got into power in a very, very peculiar election. The fascinating thing is he would never have gotten the nomination in a normal election. If he'd had to go through the Republican Party hierarchy, he would never have got there because of his relatively liberal social views. Mm-hmm. This was a chance to put somebody in the governor's office in California who would never have got elected through the standard channels. He'll be critical for them in this next election. They're very glad to have him. And I think the U.S. media were so obsessed with celebrity, the possibility that this man was a woman abuser and a racist. His father was a Nazi, and it didn't bother anyone.
We've had a great show today, Laura Flanders. I want to thank you very much for being our guest on Media Matters. And Laura Flanders is the author of Bush Women, Tales of a Cynical Species, a new book just out from Verso Press. I urge you to take a look at it. And again, thank you very much, Laura.
Thank you, Bob. It was a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana. The Corkscrew carries a full line of wines, beers, and spirits for everyone from the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held every Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. and Saturday from 2 to 6. Information available at 337-7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com.
Today in Champaign-Urbana, increasingly cloudy and breezy with occasional showers and thunderstorms during mid and late afternoon. The high in the lower 70s with south winds 15 to 25 miles per hour. Tonight, showers and thunderstorms likely in the evening, then a chance of showers after midnight. Cooler with a low in the lower 40s and west winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. You're listening to WILL Urbana, listener-supported public radio. It's 2 p.m. A Prairie Home Companion is next.